How's it going? My name is John Steyer, and you're listening to Social Echoes from True Voice Media. Welcome into the world of social business learning and all things in between. As always, you can find more episodes on our website, socialechoespodcast.com, or head to iTunes and Stitcher Radio and search Social Echoes. If you've enjoyed some of the past interviews or guests, we'd love to hear your feedback. Please leave a review and give us a rating, good, bad, or indifferent, just to get an idea of how you're liking the show and what other topics you'd like to hear us discuss. You can always tweet me, at JW Steyer, using the hashtag Social Echoes, or you can email me, John, J-O-N, at TrueVoiceMedia.com. So all the guests that we've had on Social Echoes have been incredibly smart, gracious of their time, their intelligence, they're humble professionals, but there are a few that I personally have been very excited to have on the show and converse with, and today's guest fits directly into that category. Michael Brito joins us from the Bay Area on this episode, and I'm thrilled that he has. Michael is Senior VP of Social Business Strategy at Edelman Digital. He is the author of the book Smart Business, Social Business. He's the editor of the website Social Business News, which is a great resource if you haven't already been diving into that. He is an adjunct professor at San Jose State University and UC Berkeley, teaching social business and strategic social media. And if that wasn't enough, he's the co-host of the Socialized Business podcast with Justin Levy and Jason Keith. And again, on top of all that, he's a diehard 49ers fan and a former U.S. Marine, currently making me feel lazy because he's doing the Insanity Workout program for the second time around.
That's right.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on Social Echoes.
Thank you, John, for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. So are you really doing Insanity for the second time in a row?
I am. I worked out this morning, and I'm on day seven of the second cycle. And I'm following your stuff, too. It sounds like you've done a lot of work working out with the 180 days. I'm not quite sure what's behind that. But, it's changed my life. Insanity has certainly gotten me motivated to eat more healthy, to work out daily. And I just overall feel extremely good.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because, as I mentioned, you are a former Marine. You spent 8 years in the Marine Corps. And I remember asking you one time if Insanity was harder than any of the Marine workouts, and you said yes, and I kind of just sat back in the chair after reading that and was like, whoa, that's some pretty high praise from somebody who's obviously been through the ringer, and having known a couple of Marines myself, I have a lot of respect for the work that you guys do, obviously, and the service that you've done, but just the physical grunt work that has to go into before you're even a Marine, it's insanity.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I joined the Marine Corps when I was 18.
Wow.
I started Insanity when I was 39. So that's why it might be hard, because I'm old. So my knees crack, my neck hurts, my back's always hurting. But when I was 19, I mean, and in the military, what was hard for me in the military was more the psychological, right? Because especially in boot camp, they really try to break you down psychologically. And of course, you're humping and you're doing all this hard work physically. But the hard part for me back then was the psychology behind it. Today with Insanity, and thankful to my wife, it's more just because my body's older. It's been, you know, 20 years since I did that. But you know, I'm almost at that weight where I was when I got out of the military. I got out of the military, I was lean, 175 at, you know, 5'9". I'm at 185 now, and I started Insanity in December. I was 210.
For those of you that aren't familiar with what Michael was referring to with me, and I'm doing this thing called Project 180, and you can check more of that out at HTTP, project180.me. I started out on November 20th of this past year at 261 pounds at 24 years old, and, you know, days later turned 25. I have struggled with my own weight, you know, and not to get into this whole, you know, health debate type thing, but I struggled with my own weight my entire life, especially around middle high school. I kind of ballooned, and highest I got was 287. And two or three years ago, I lost 40 pounds on my own, 20 of it kept back. And I just said, you know what, enough. I just want to nail it in the butt. And I got in touch with a doctor who is a client of ours at True Voice Media, and he was on board with the idea. He's been fantastic. And to this day, I've lost 18 pounds. You know, it's a slow, gradual process. but it's 18 pounds. I'm still building muscle and losing a lot of fat, and it's been a life-changing experience thus far, and I'm only 116 days in, and I can't wait to see where I am in a month, 2 months, etc., because I feel great, and I'm eager to get down to the weight, like right around where you are, 180, which is kind of like the message of the Project 180. It's a flip, from the 360 degrees. You just want to flip it halfway to go the opposite direction. So I appreciate your kind words and everything with that. And I, one day maybe we'll try out Insanity, and we'll see how that goes.
I highly recommend it.
All right, Michael. So let's get into the meat of the conversation. You are so involved with social business, but I'm curious as to kind of what piqued your interest in social business to the point where you're now senior VP at Edelman for social business strategy.
That's a great question. And, I think it stemmed from actually working in large organizations. And, most of my career I worked here in Silicon Valley for HP, for Intel, for Yahoo for a short time. And as social media began to grow and influence large brands in 2002 to 2005, I saw just the chaos and the insanity that was happening internally. And so when you think about social business really focuses on building that infrastructure within any large or medium, small size organization. So the fact that I lived through that as social became, evolved and became kind of almost in everyday conversation, that's kind of what prompted me to start talking with clients about it. And Edelman is such a entrepreneurial type company, and they're very supportive. They kind of just put me into this position, and it's to this day I'm helping companies navigate the internal dynamics of social media so that they can better focus on content strategy, so they can better focus on analytics, and so they can better focus on building more effective customer relationships.
So to that point, a lot of the conversations that we have here, we're not working with the same size brands that you are at Edelman, but the conversations I would think are kind of similar because people are just the same, just working on different levels and different number strategies. But what are the biggest pitfalls you think when businesses think of social business as a phrase, like a doctored up phrasing of social media?
Well, it's not the same thing. I mean, there's so many different terminologies and definitions out there. When I think about social media, whether it's for a large brand or small, it's this idea of socializing the customer experience, right? So you're using Twitter, you're using Facebook or Google Plus or whatever, and you're communicating with customers, and that's social media. That is the effect of a good social brand. Social business is that underlying layer. The social business enables, even small companies, enables companies to be better at social media. So instead of launching 25 different Twitter accounts and 15 Facebook pages, the infrastructure that you create, the training and the guidelines and the playbooks that you're putting together for internal teams helps navigate what they do from an external perspective. And what's interesting, and we talked about the book earlier, my first book was very much focused on this idea that business in general should be a social business for the sake of being a social business. There's so much more to that. And when you think about content strategy, when you think about measurement analytics, when you think about CRM and customer relationship management, all of social business enables that. It helps drive more effective brand communications. And so that's currently what I'm working on right now with clients. It's not let's be a social business just because. Let's be a social business and fix some of this stuff. Let's audit some of this stuff. Let's make sure that we're not launching a new Twitter account with every new product launch, or we're not we have very much focused conversations and focused relationships with clients rather than different groups having different conversations. Excuse me.
So how then do you, when you're having these discussions with these companies about, And it's a lot of the same things that we're having here in Philadelphia when we're talking to a company and we're trying to get them away from strictly just a Facebook and a Pinterest kind of strategy and the mindset. There's always going to be a cynic and somebody just saying, well, this is just like I was like my question before, this is just a new way of talking about social media. And there's just trying to get us to sign on for a 6-month engagement or whatever. How do you convince a cynic that social business tools and principles should be explored and that there is honest to goodness, real business value?
That's a great question, actually. You know, and typically the way that we start off any engagement is by doing an audit, right? So doing a conversation audit, what are the conversations happening? And then also doing an internal audit. Is there anyone responsible for responding to comments on a Facebook page? Is there anyone responsible for responding to at replies on Twitter or questions on Instagram or whatever it is? And usually there's not, or it's one person, it's their part-time job. And by doing the audit, we can see where there's disconnects. Oh, well, you had an opportunity to change a customer's mind, but you didn't hear. So showing them data, showing them kind of real-time customer conversations, and showing them and really highlighting the opportunity cost of not being engaged, of not being involved. And that usually opens the eyes of cynics. And when they see the data, it helps them kind of humanize it a little bit and say, okay, well, maybe we do need to invest in, excuse me, hiring more people or investing in a listening platform like Radiant 6 or Sysimos, or investing in a platform like Sprout Social or Sprinklr, whatever, so that you can have, you know, one platform that is publishing to multiple streams. So it does take some convincing because there are a lot of cynics out there. But if you can show them the data, show them the opportunity cost of not investing in a piece of software or not having a workflow and working with customer service, usually it opens their eyes. And it usually starts out as project-based, right? So let's try one project and let's see if that works and let's see if we can get any early wins. And if we do, then we kind of expand our social business programs.
So how about with Edelman? Edelman is a big name in the agency space, the creative space, and now in the social business space, and rightfully so, because you guys are doing great work. And as you were just talking about a lot of the different software platforms, is Edelman's platform software agnostic? Do you kind of assess each case-by-case basis? Do you have software partners? I'm sure you do. Is there one that you kind of recommend more so than others?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we are platform agnostic, and it really does depend upon what our clients, what their requirements are, or, you know, what contracts that they have already signed. I mean, some clients, when we win new business, they already have Radiant 6, so we have to work with Radiant 6. Or Sysimos, or Visible Technologies. I mean, there's millions of them. So, I mean, I have my favorites, and I'm not going to tell you what they are because I have friends at almost every company.
Right.
But yeah, it certainly does depend. I mean, when a client says, we need a content publishing platform, we have 50 contributors who are posting content, we have 5 Facebook pages globally, and here's what's important to us, workflow, analytics. Well, there's 3 tools that come to mind, right, that off the top of my head. One is Sprinklr, another is Spreadfast, and then another is Expion. And Expion is actually a client of one of Edelman's sister agencies. Those all have capabilities around workflows and being able to publish to multiple streams and analytics. So, and then at that point, it's just a matter of cost. So we do the analysis. We do come to the table to the clients and say, here's the 3 options. Here's what they're going to cost, and we work with them to make a collaborative decision.
So when an Edelman is initially starting a new conversation with a company, a brand new client, you know, the contract's just been signed, et cetera, what does that initial, you know, audit process look like? Are you doing the entire business holistically, or is it you're kind of infiltrating through one department initially, and then you're kind of chirping in different people's ears that you're trying to get into, you know, the larger space of the entire organization?
Usually it's the latter, and I think that's with most agencies, right? Because, you know, marketing hires an agency, PR hires an agency, and then it's about making an impact and driving that internal collaboration. So it usually starts out in the digital marketing organization or corporate communications. And, you know, when we talk about social business, it does mean more than marketing. So when we say we need to make sure that we're being proactive with content and develop a content strategy, but we also need to be reactive with content and develop a support strategy. So that entails us to help some clients, and some clients already have a bridge with customer support, or with clients that have multiple products, you know, building collaboration models with them so that we're kind of all in line and in sync with a very consistent content strategy. So it's usually the latter, where we kind of infiltrate one department and we kind of branch out and build the Edelman roots into these different organizations to make sure that we have one cohesive strategy.
Yeah, and I think that's, as you mentioned, it's the way that it looks for the majority of agencies, regardless of how large the company is. You're getting into conversations with the people that you need to have the initial conversations with, the ones that it looks most familiar with, and then you kind of expand out from there. So to that point as well, to that question, is there an ideal candidate for a social business? And at the other end, are there some organizations that just don't fit it at all?
I mean, I would say that the perfect candidate is somebody who, obviously, in my opinion, who has experience working in and not necessarily working for a company, but whether consulting or even agency people who have worked with clients to help navigate social media policies or kind of social business is very much operational, right? It's the infrastructure. I wish I could show you a graphic, but I have a graphic that has where you have social business initiatives, and at the top you have social brand or social media initiatives, and it shows how each stream of social business has a positive impact on social media or being a social brand. And so the ideal candidate should have some experience. Certainly project management is always a good skill set to have, or any type of change management experience that is also good. And then content is really a driver of social business, if you think about it. I mean, we as business professionals, everything that we do is content. And when you're trying to persuade another team to hop on board an initiative, you do that with content. So having people who understand content and who are influential and have good persuasion skills are I think make good candidates for social business. And in terms of your second question, and you know, is social business for everyone? I mean, I would say yes, but I mean for the dentist office who has $2,000 a month to do it, probably not. But they don't need it, right? It's a dentist and his partners and a receptionist or whoever. And so no, but I think that understanding the principles of it is important. So they would need to go hire an Edelman or hire a consultant. They can they probably get it themselves. But medium to small, small, medium to large businesses, I think, would benefit from at least understanding the principles of social business. Because most likely they're going to grow and scale. And as they grow and scale, that's when the issues come in, right? And having a solid infrastructure in place will help navigate through that complexity.
Michael, to the graph thing, if you're kind enough to send me a link to that, I will link that in the blog post when I put the show up.
Sure.
So talking about scale, scale obviously allows social business allows scalability a lot better, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any examples of some of the vast array of companies that you've worked with that have kind of implemented that really well, the ability to scale after going to the social business model?
You know, it all starts and whenever I talk about social business, I mean, there's a process. We have a framework that does this. One of the first things that we do is we start thinking about building a centralized team, and that centralized team is responsible for content. They're responsible for technology. They're responsible for process, people, process, and technology. And so this team can consist of two people. It can consist of 10 people, and so this team is going to be the ones that are going to be almost the bottleneck, right, of scale. So you have this team here, you have growth here, but you have a bottleneck of implementing social media. So the bottleneck is important in this perspective because it allows you to kind of stop, assess the situation, decide how you want to go to market with this new product or that new product, or there's a new marketing team and how they fit into the mold. But the centralized team is really meant to assess the situation and then scale appropriately with the organization. So I would say building a team is probably the first thing that you want to do.
Building a team, it also kind of goes back to your writings about social media command center. How important is that for a large brand to kind of have a social business or a social media command center? Seeing a lot more of that now, one of the interesting, I watched last night your Hootsuite video that you partnered up with Hootsuite. You did about an hour seminar, and you talked about command centers. How vital are those types of bunkers for brands moving forward?
Well, I mean, command centers are good for two reasons, or for many, but I clump them in kind of two buckets. Excuse me. I'm getting over a cold, by the way.
Oh, so I am too. We're in the same boat.
Yeah. Well, the first bucket is really reactionary, right? So you have customer support teams who are monitoring conversations. You have PR and crisis teams. You have community managers who are monitoring brand conversations and responding, right? And they're responding with the community and they're building customer advocacy. That's one stream. And a lot of platforms have that capability. People Browser, Hootsuite has their command center. Trax has a command center. Several companies are starting to productize this idea. The second piece of command centers is this idea of capitalizing on the news cycle. Okay, so going back to the Oreos example during the Super Bowl, right? Real-time marketing. And that, and I was, by the way, I missed that whole halftime show because I was depressed because my Niners were down 17 points. Anyhow, but this command center is now companies like SocialFlow, a great platform where they're surfacing trends within your community and surfacing trends and hot topics outside of your community. So as a brand, now you're saying, oh, this is coming down the pipeline. How do we be a part of this conversation, right? Oreo did a great job. But the thing about Oreo is that didn't just happen overnight, right? They've been building this real-time creative newsroom, which I would say you need a social business plan to do that, right? Exactly. So they've done that. They've been doing it for almost a year, I think. Where they're and we saw the fail during the Oscars, where all these companies were trying to mimic them.
And Jay Baer, I think, did a really good job. Not to interrupt you, Jay Baer did a really good job, kind of summarizing that whole thing.
Oh yeah, no, I read that post, and Jay's a good friend. But but the thing is that wasn't even real time marketing. Right, because if you think about what Oreos did, that was unplanned. That was not planned. The Oscars have been planned for years. Everybody knew the Oscars were winning. Everybody knew who was going to win. So these brands, they sucked at basically providing this real time or quote unquote real time content, but it just wasn't very funny. It wasn't very. They didn't capitalize good enough. So from a command center perspective, you have your proactive command center, right? So being able to look at trends and seeing how we can be involved in the conversation. Then you have your reactive, which is more about support, crisis, things like that.
My favorite response in the Super Bowl was the Audi Instagram photo. I guess it got on Instagram because I saw CeCe Chapman had it up, but it was responsive on Twitter because the Superdome lights go out. Superdome name is owned by Mercedes-Benz, and Audi then jumped on saying Mercedes-Benz kind of dropped the ball with their lighting, and Audi said, here's some LED lights for you, which I just thought was great because I'm also a big fan of Audi. If I could drive one, I would.
Well, it's funny because I think I saw another tweet that said, what happened? They basically called out Mercedes and they said, did Mercedes forget to pay their electrical bill or something hysterical like that? That was good too.
And the great thing too is that they were announcing a brand new car, and they had a great commercial too, but it can't do anything about that. I mean, that's not, if you look at it, you're like, well, it's not really Mercedes' fault, but it's like, well, you're guilty by association.
Exactly.
So getting back to the command center thing, in the Hootsuite. We're True Voice Media is a big Hootsuite, fans of Hootsuite. We've been hooked up very nicely by the company. Thank you to Laura Horak in New York City. But one of the cool things about the command centers that you were talking about is the ability for storytelling. And Michael, I love storytelling. It's part of my everyday job here at True Voice Media. And it's very interesting that these command centers are excellent for leveraging storytelling. So how are they being leveraged for brand narratives?
Well, when I think about a content strategy, I mean, a brand narrative, most companies already have a brand narrative, right? I mean, if you look at what their website, I mean, that is their brand narrative. Their collateral is their brand narrative. And when you look at some of their paid media initiatives, that is part of the brand narrative. But when you think about, you take it one step further and you say, how do you translate the narrative into a story that people can actually understand and deal with and accept? You can't just take the brand narrative and tweet it out, right? Because we as consumers reject that. We don't want to care about the brand narrative. We want you to tell us stories. What's important to us and how can you provide us with a story that we care about? So when I think about like this idea of building a content strategy, and a content strategy is going to help people like you and I help our companies and clients have conversations in all these different channels, including paid media. So when I think about that content strategy, there are several different inputs to a content strategy. One of them is the brand narrative. What is the value proposition of my brand? How do we talk about it? How do we position it? When we read a white paper, when we go to the about section on the website, what are we saying about ourselves, about our products? That is one input into this. Imagine a bucket of your content strategy. One input is a brand narrative. Another input is perceptions, media perceptions of the brand. So when the Wall Street Journal or a local newspaper, when they write about your company, what do they say? How do they refer to you? How do they refer to your brand? Then that's number two. The third one is the community. When they're responding to you and having conversations with you, what do they call you? How do they talk about you? When they talk to their friends, what are they saying about you? The fourth piece is, and this is important, is what are your fans' interests when they're not talking with you or talking about you? So we found one client, a high percentage of our friends, fans, and followers liked music, and we pulled that through some data. So we began to think about how we can build our narrative around music, right? So you had your fan interests. Then you have search behavior. How do people use Google to search for information, right? If you sell laptops, are they searching for a notebook or a laptop or mobile, whatever other variations there are? But all these inputs go into this content strategy. And that content strategy then requires some smart and creative people to kind of get into a room and say, okay, we have all these inputs. Now how do we tell the story in a way that capitalizes on search, that is relevant to our consumers, that contains our brand message, but isn't necessarily our quote unquote brand narrative? Because we reject brand narratives. But then some would argue that content strategy is part of the brand narrative, and I would say it is, but to make things black and white, because I like to bucket things in black and white, just makes it easier. That I like to delineate the difference between a kind of a core brand narrative and how you deliver that brand narrative through content.
So of the storytelling thing, the ability to storytell is so crucial for the success of any company. But the fact that social tools and social media has given us as individuals and companies the ability to be our own media companies. And you've written a lot about that. You've spoken a lot about that recently. I'm of the opinion that these journalism skills are very important for organizations to have within their ranks so that they can kind of capitalize on the how they become a media company. But what do you think this means to folks kind of becoming a media company? And do you think who do you think are the companies that are already making this transition successfully?
Okay. Well, that's actually going to be the topic of book number two. So I'm glad you asked.
Oh, good. I got there organically. Yeah, that's good.
You got there organically. Thank you. But what I would say is that, every company is not a media company, But every company should start thinking like one. Every company should start thinking like one. Because do you, John, let me ask you a question. Do you read,
Sure.
do you ever come across articles from Forbes
All
online?
the time, all the time.
All the time, all the time. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they didn't exist.
Nope.
Now Forbes has always been a media company though, right? They've been having a magazine for years. The reason why today they kind of dominate, I mean, them and, you know, Mashable, of course, but I would say I see more content from Forbes now that I do more so than from Mashable these days. But Forbes has hundreds of contributing writers. They're not paid. I mean, Forbes has a paid staff, but they have hundreds of people who are writing guest content. And obviously they get to link back, you know, they get the link love, they get to be able to, they can put it in their bio that they're a Forbes
Forbes
columnist,
contributor,
right?
yeah.
That's great. But now Forbes has a ton of content. They're reaching all these people, they're dominating search. Companies need to start thinking that way. Companies with large employee bases, think of them as contributors. Think of them as giving them the opportunity to feed the content engine, leveraging customers and partners if you're in B2B in the supply chain, leveraging them to feed that content engine. That's why Forbes is so successful today. So every company has the opportunity to be a media company. Now, when I say that, I don't necessarily mean you need to start selling advertising on your website. Media companies, that's how most of them make money. But what I'm saying is that you're and most of your clients have business objectives, right? They want to sell more products. They want to increase market share. They want to decrease retention or increase retention. So that is still important. But this idea from a content perspective, to start thinking like a media company, every company has the opportunity to do that. And they should start thinking about that. And I'm not going to, in fact, the book that I'm writing, it's not the why. I think we all know why. It's the how. It's how to implement social business strategy to take you away from brand marketing and more into media company from a content marketing perspective.
Very cool. Eager to read that book now, because I think there's, as you were talking about, the Forbes example, and that's a great one, that there is just so much opportunity, and the market is rife with it. The interesting thing, I think it's Forbes. I could be wrong, so don't quote me on it. But if I am right, go ahead and quote me on it. One of the good things that Forbes does is when they write a piece of content and they post it on their blog or their website first, so it's exposed to the online masses for free first. They still have their magazine, and the way that they have been utilizing the same content is by whenever a commenter adds a comment, if it's a really good one, it starts like a new debate. The writing staff and the editing staff take that, they alter it, augment it, and then add it into the article. And then they post it and they publish it in the magazine, the physical magazine or the iPad edition or whatever. And that has become a really good way for them to, keep not always produce, content after content after exhausting article, but it keeps it fresh, keeps it new, but it also keeps that same old article, it gives it longer shelf life. So I think that's a really great idea. I'm interested that more newspapers haven't used that type of strategy, because why would I buy, for me, that why would I buy the Philadelphia Inquirer when I have philly.com at my disposal any time of the day or night? So that's
That's a good point. I haven't, I don't subscribe to Forbes outside of going to their website, so I
yeah,
wouldn't know
either
that.
do
But
I.
what's interesting though is like you talked about the fact that they're curating their own content. They're curating and adding annotations to their own content, which is interesting. And content curation is certainly should be a part of your content strategy. Companies like Percolate or Publish This have these mechanisms that allow you to do that. And but it shouldn't be your own focus point. I mean, that's part of it, but content creation is certainly a big piece of it as well. But yeah, I mean, I think companies, if you think about us as consumers, I mean, we live in a multi-screen economy. So the fact that they're publishing it for their print, for their iPad or Android, tablets, and it's that same content but framed in a different way, now all of a sudden they become, think about it from a business perspective. I mean, you're trying to change behavior of your customers and trying to acquire new ones. you have to reach them with multiple touch points. So it's not just Twitter, not just Facebook, but it's mobile devices. It's, you know, paid media. It's in some cases billboards, you know, magazines. It's everything. It's the entire communications platform.
Speaking of mobile devices, did you catch any of the Samsung Galaxy S4 launch last night?
I did. Yeah, Samsung is a client of ours. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I am very excited about the device. The performance at Radio City Music Hall was interesting, and I will leave it at that, considering that they are a client of yours. But I know the internet had some very interesting opinions. I was very excited, and I am still very excited about the device, and hopefully that will be my next smartphone.
Yeah, well, I love technology, and it's not good because my wife gets irritated at me because every new device I have to get.
Yeah.
So I mean, marketers and brands need to really think about 5 years ago it was just optimizing content for different resolutions on Macs or PCs and screens, LCD screens. Now it's like you have, you know, iPad minis and Android tablets and Microsoft devices and Blackberries now.
Kindles,
Blackberry.
Yeah.
Everything. It's getting expensive because now you have to think about the multitude of screen sizes that you need to optimize for.
So, Michael, you're an adjunct professor on top of everything else, and being an author, writer, contributor, speaker, full-time dad. So you are at San Jose State and UC Berkeley. Are they both still correct?
That's correct.
Okay, cool. What are some of the different conversations that you're having with students, and what are some of the different topics of conversation that seem to come up, whether it's just in the classroom or interactions out of the classroom, during office hours? What are you talking to them about? I'm sure that's a whole other conversation, but kind of just what seems to be something that continues to come up?
That's a great question. I would say that both classes are completely different. So San Jose State, I teach undergrads, and they are in the PR, journalism, and advertising school. They're younger. They're like 22 to 24. UC Berkeley, it's their extension program, and these are working adults who are going back to Berkeley to get a certificate in marketing. So what I teach them, I both teach them social business strategy, right? And there are some classes where it's like Twitter 101, but then it's like organizationally, how do you do this and how do you do it the right way? So the curriculum is the same, but the way that I talk about it is much different. So the way that I talk to students, it's very much theoretical and case studies, right? Because they're kids. The working adults is very actionable. It's like, here's what you need to do today to make sure that you're capitalizing on this. Because their employers are paying like $800, $900 per person to send them to an 8-week course. They want some level of return, right? Whereas the San Jose State students, you know, they either have a student loan, or in some cases they're just there to take the class and have fun, right? They don't really care about social. But so I'm teaching them real world social business, which is and there's a few stars in that class. You know, there's like, I can count them on one hand, who I know that they're gonna like graduate and really kick butt wherever they go. So I'm teaching them everything I know. And I'm excited about it because when I look at resumes and I hire people, I don't see any educational system right now providing the right level of education and the right content for me to like hire them right out of college. They don't have it. So I'm trying to, you know, do my best to make an impact to make that happen.
It's fascinating that you said that, because I've actually, this is my third podcast this week. On Monday, I was interviewing my good buddy at Ready App in Louisville, Kentucky, Patrick Goodman, and we were having a conversation.
Oh, I know Patrick.
Do you?
He's a great guy. They have a great, great app.
Yeah, Patrick has been so good to me personally and professionally, and we've teamed up on Social Echoes, and it's kind of like the aural version of mobile chat, and kind of just, you know, once a month we talk about mobile and everything like that. But he was kind of we ended up talking about schools. I don't know how we got on the topic, but just how kind of like what you were just saying, that there's nothing really kind of out there that's ingrained in X amount of different school systems that you're teaching at SJ and UC. But that's wonderful. I mean, it's probably something I would love, especially if you're giving them everything that you know. It's probably a lot, and they're going to be better off for it. So good for you, and good for them as well.
Thank you.
Michael, thank you very much for all your time on the show. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Really do enjoy having conversations with really smart people, and you're definitely in the upper echelon of that category. Where can folks go to be social with you?
Sure. So you can, the best place is Twitter, you know, and it's at Britopian, Britopian. And, you know, also I'm working on book two. I'm actually halfway done writing it. And it's, the title of the book is Your Brand, The Next Media Company: How Social Business Strategies Enable Better Content, Smarter Marketing, and More Effective Customer Relationships. And, you can find more information on that at, thenextmedia.co, which is the next media company, thenextmedia.co. Sign up to be notified when it's available for pre-order. And other than that, I mean, you know, if you were to Google Britopian, I'm in every network known to man, but I spend most times on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook are the three that I spend most of my days in.
Yeah, I'm a testament that I can agree with all three of the things you just said: Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Yeah. You've been very gracious with your time with me and your responses. You know, can't wait to explore more of the book that you're going to have, and all things Michael Brito. Thank you so much.
And by the way, man, you gotta try Insanity. It's the most amazing platform ever.
I certainly will, and keep rooting for me, because
I will
as the weight kind of comes off more and more, it gets harder and harder. But just to lose, you know, a couple pounds, it's interesting.
Well, like Sean T says, Sean T is the coach.
Yeah.
I follow him everywhere. He's actually been an inspiration. What he tells you throughout these workouts is, and I hashtag it all the time, dig deeper, and that's what gets me through those workouts.
Yeah, Dr. Charlie Seltzer and I are going to be doing a photo shoot and a video of one of his workouts that he came up with. And I'll tell you what, it's a hard. It's not Insanity, but it's a little bit kind of in the same realm. It starts out with hypertrophy, and then it goes into the metabolic circuit, and then it's just cardio for, like, you know, 10, 15 minutes after the entire workout. It's rough, but that's a conversation for another day. To everybody else that's listening out there, thank you so much for listening to Social Echoes. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Leave us a rating. Gives us an idea of how we are doing and how we can better serve you. To that same point, you can always leave me an email, John, J-O-N, at truevoicemedia.com. And you can tweet me at J.W. Steiert, at J-W-S-T-E-I-E-R-T. With the hashtag Social Echoes, if you have any guests or whatever. We will see you guys next time on Social Echoes. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. We'll see you later.